Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza, working on this pre-recorded program via remote. Here are some of the top stories making news across Sudan and South Sudan this Thursday, November 18, 2021. Sudanese Doctors Association say 14 protesters were killed in Khartoum on Wednesday.
The total number of those killed is 14. P1 is very ill and in ICU, and we don't know. Some reports say this morning that he died, but I'm not sure.
And 60 South Sudanese are detained in Sudan for entering the country illegally.
Now the Relief and Rehabilitation Commission is working on it, and they say that those people detained are refugees. Anyone who flees his country without any document is considered a refugee.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. Sudanese Doctors Association and the police in Khartoum are providing contradicting figures on the death toll during Wednesday's protest. The Doctors Association say at least 14 protesters were killed on Wednesday in Khartoum and more than 50 others wounded, with some in critical conditions. The Sudanese police say only one protester died due to tear gas and around 30 others were wounded. For VOA News, Michael Atit reports from Khartoum.
The Sudanese police spokesperson late Wednesday said, after reviewing all police department records in the state, they found that only one person died in Bahri locality. The statement said 30 protesters were injured by breathing tear gas. The police said 89 policemen were seriously injured, one truck was burned, and its contents were looted. They said three police trucks were destroyed in Jebel Awliya locality in Khartoum and Umbada locality of Omdurman. The police statement denied using firearms against the protesters, but says that police officers have a legal duty to prevent any destruction of property. Walidin Al-Faki, a member of the executive board of the Sudanese Doctors Association, says according to their findings from different public and private hospitals around Khartoum, 14 people were confirmed to have died during yesterday's protest. Speaking to South Sudan in Focus by phone, he says 8 of the deaths were caused by gunshot wounds to the chest.
The total number of those killed is 14. P1 is very ill and in ICU, and we don't know. Some reports say this morning that he died, but I'm not sure. But the total number of those killed is 14. This is definitely most of them killed in Bahri Muassasa.
Al-Faki said most of those who were killed in Bahri were caught up around a police truck that was left behind. He said reinforcements from the paramilitary rapid support forces came and started shooting directly at protesters. He said 5 protesters died on the scene and others died in hospitals due to severe bleeding.
The police left their car because their tear gas is stuck. They get out of the stock of tear gas, they left of tear gas. Those from Dantre came and start to fire directly.
Al-Faki said more than 100 wounded protesters were taken to the nearby hospital. He says some of the injured are in critical conditions and others have responded well to the treatment. He said because telecommunications were cut, the administration of Al-Dawli Hospital in Khartoum North sought help from mosques to call for doctors and nurses to come help save lives.
They call doctors from the nearby areas. From the mosque, by the microphones of the mosque, they call for help because there are a lot of injured patients, more than 100.
Last Saturday, the Sudanese doctors said 6 protesters were also shot and killed by the security forces and 27 others injured. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit in Khartoum.
The U.S. Assistant Secretary of State, Molly Fee, concluded a 3-day visit to Sudan where she met Army leader General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan and discussed ways to restore Sudan's democratic transition. He also met with Sudan's ousted Prime Minister Abdullah Hamdok and Mariam al-Sadiq, foreign minister in the administration that Burhan dissolved, to show U.S. support for a civilian-led transitional government. Cameron Hudson, a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council and former director of African Affairs at the National Security Council, discussed with VOA's senior analyst Mohammed Al-Ashanawi whether U.S. mediation could lead to a restoration of Sudan's democratic transition.
I don't think so right now. I think that the statements that we're seeing from General Burhan and from the members of the military government that are around him suggest that the pressure from the United States and from outside the country is not sufficient at this time to get them to change their approach to this. They think that they can either wait out pressure from the international community or that the international community will grow tired of this and just choose to move on. So I actually don't feel that they are experiencing a lot of pressure from the United States or others. The U.S. has not discussed any kind of sanctions on the military. There have been no consequences, no costs to the military for this action. Yes, there has been a suspension of assistance, but the military believes that that assistance is going to be restored at any moment. And so whether or not Prime Minister Hamdok is returned to office. So I just don't think that the military feels any pressure from this. They're continuing to arrest and detain and kill people in the streets while at the same time, you know, negotiating for their, you know, holding on to power. So I don't understand why we think that this pressure from the United States is anything more than a distraction for the military at this time.
Local resistance committees across the capital, Khartoum, tried to protest on main roads and inside neighborhoods on Wednesday, demanding a full handover to civilian authorities and that coup leaders be tried in court. Do protesters still have the same power they had when their pressure managed to topple autocrat Omar al-Bashir in 2019, when al-Burhan security forces are cracking down on peaceful demonstrations?
Well, I think it's yet to be seen. Clearly that the military is doing what it can right now to weaken this protest movement. As you said, they're cutting off roads to limit the size of the protest movement. They're cut off telecommunications inside the country, which is a new move. Obviously, the internet has been shut off for the better part of the last month. So they are taking steps to try to weaken the ability of the protest movement to organize, to take to the streets. But I don't think that anything that they're doing is weakening the resolve. It might be weakening their ability, but it certainly hasn't weakened their resolve to see the military removed from power, to see the prime minister restored and civilian government in the country restored. I do think, however, though, we have to be careful about how we view the power of the street and what happened in 2019. I'm obviously a big supporter of this democratic movement, but we have to be very clear that they did not take Omar al-Bashir out of power. It was the military that removed Bashir. And we have to remember that they did it to save themselves. They removed Bashir to relieve pressure on themselves, not as a response to the street, not as a response to international pressure. And I think we have to revisit how we view the strength of the democracy movement in Sudan right now. It has not been getting the international support that it needs. The military removed Bashir. That bought them 2 years of a transitional government, but that hasn't been enough. It hasn't satisfied the demands of the people. Now they have no one left to remove. And so I think we are seeing them dig in because they have no way of relieving the pressure right now. And that's a very dangerous situation.
Washington succeeded so far in coaxing a strong consensus from the United Nations Security Council to restore the civilian-led transitional government in Sudan. What's missing, in your opinion, in the U.S. reaction to the coup in Sudan?
Well, what's missing is any real pressure on the military. You know, the military is sitting in power. It enjoys control over the military corporations. It wants to appoint all of the members of a civilian government. It feels no consequences for having violated the constitutional order and holding the prime minister under house arrest for the last 3 weeks. So what's missing from the U.S. reaction is everything. The only thing that Washington has done is really words. And I don't feel like those words have had the impact that we want them to. And so Washington needs to continue to try to put together a coalition of Arab states to condemn this and to make sure that the military knows that outside actors will not be coming to the rescue financially for Sudan. But also, I think the United States has a has an opportunity here to impose real costs on the military and its allies, the RSF and others, through a series of very targeted sanctions to demonstrate, not just to say that we are condemning the coup, but to demonstrate, to take firm action that we are demonstrating against this coup. That's what's been missing from the U.S. response from the beginning.
That's Cameron Hudson, a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council and former director of African Affairs at the National Security Council. He was speaking with VOA's senior analyst Muhammad Al-Ashanawi. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken arrived in Senegal Thursday as part of his first tour of Africa since the Biden administration took office. U.S.-Senegal relations expert Alpha Bodian spoke to Ricky Schreib about U.S. concerns such as security and offshore oil in Senegal.
The relations have been consolidated and have been evolving positively, that we can say. Even if we tap our memories, everybody remembers President Diouf's visit to in Washington. And people had a little problem because President Abdou Diouf, being very tall, they were just racking their brain to find the possibility to give him a bed, which would be as large and as long as the president was. So these are anecdotes we can tell. We also remember the visit of President Bill Clinton and, of course, the visit of Barack Obama. So these have been consolidating the relations between the United States and Senegal, and you know, Senegal got the Millennium Challenge account from the American administration, and USAID is still around.
Do you think, though, that given the recent years of destabilization in the Sahel, that the relationship between the U.S. and Senegal has become, the militaries of the two countries have become more intertwined?
What I can say from a military perspective is that for some time, senior officers in the Senegalese army have had the possibility to go and get further trained at West Point. I also know that American military can be seen around here doing some sort of practice and collaborating with their Senegalese counterparts. You don't have a massive presence of American militaries, but they certainly are around here and work with the Senegalese counterparts in terms of drills.
If one were to say the relationship is one that is mutually beneficial, what would Senegal's benefit be from its relationship with U.S. And vice versa?
I don't know if the relationship or the exchanges are balanced, but I know that Senegal had the opportunity, which was offered by an initiative taken by President Bill Clinton called AGOA, Africa Growth Opportunity Act, and which stated that much as goods from the United States could be commercialized in Senegal, Senegal also had the opportunity to export and commercialize goods. But I know that the United States Department of Agriculture is very, very strict as to farming goods which are authorized to just be commercialized in the United States. But that was an opportunity. This MCA Millennium Challenge account also is an opportunity which Senegal is taking advantage of. And Senegal is not, there are not many countries on the continent taking advantage of those opportunities. The second phase of this MCA is going to help Senegal further electrify the remotest part of the country. This is no small thing.
That was U.S.-Senegal relations expert Alpha Bodian. He was speaking to Ricky Shryok from Dakar, Senegal. You are listening to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. Coming up, a peace signatory in South Sudan accuses President Salva Kiir of delaying the unification of forces. Find out why after the break.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
can you share an inspirational quote and where you heard it from? Heavy rains are a reminder of challenges in life. Never ask for a lighter rain. Just pray for better umbrella. I just came across it while I was reading something on social media.
This quote I just added from church. The father was like, "For those who seek, always find. And so fight endlessly for what you want for the future."
Friends are like buttons on the lift. They either bring you down or take you up. I heard it while I was in secondary school and it stuck since then.
وَمَنْ يَتَّقِ اللَّهِ يَجْعَلْ لَهُ مَخْرَجًا. Whoever fears Allah will have solution to whatever problems. It is from the Holy Quran.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. The military spokesperson of the SPLM in opposition, loyal to South Sudan's first Vice President Riek Machar, says delays in graduating and unifying forces of the parties in the unity government is caused by what he called tactical move by President Salva Kiir's side to frustrate security arrangement. Colonel Lam Gabriel says the SPLM IO has decided to screen its forces at cantonment sites. For VOA News, Wake Simon Wudu reports from Juba.
As IO, we are making a very strong statement that we want peace to move forward. We want the agreement to move forward, regardless whether there is money or no money.
That is Colonel Lampol Gabriel speaking to journalists on Wednesday, shortly after the top military leadership of the SPLIO ended a meeting. They gathered to discuss challenges surrounding the implementation of the security arrangements and to forge a way forward. Gabriel says President Salva Kiir's office in September directed various committees to begin screening forces in training camps with the aim of unifying the different armed groups into a single South Sudan force. However, Gabriel says no action has been taken because the leadership of the various parties to the peace deal have been told by the National Transitional Committee that there is no money to do the screening.
We have come to Juba since 2018, December to today, and things are not really moving very well. And every single time we move two steps in front, we get stuck or even move back. So the steps are not moving forward. So this is intentional. We always call it that lack of resources here and there, but we know it is intentional. It is meant to disorganize the SPLIO.
Gabriel says the SPLIO does not think there are no resources to implement the security arrangements. He says, for instance, some of the SPLMIO leaders who have recently allied with the IGO in government party have been given brand new vehicles and money. He says the vehicles and cars given to the cadres of the SPLMIO who defected to the IG source that they claim that there is no money to implement the security arrangements is false.
We know we'll face challenge of transportation, but we task our leadership to be able to get for us transport so that we're able to reach these training centers. We know that there are forces who are still out of the training centers, and we know that there are challenges of lack of food in the training centers. So the SPLIO have decided to face this challenge together with the forces in the training center.
According to the agreed-on security arrangements, screening committees of the various parties are to jointly travel to training camps and conduct the screening. Gabriel says the SPLIO wants to see a change in how the IG implements the security arrangements. He says the SPLIO calls the IG to reconsider efforts and moves that jeopardize the effective implementation of the peace deal. Major General Lulruy Kwong, the South Sudan Army spokesperson, said only that there is challenge to funding the implementation programs.
We have been experiencing difficulties in mobilizing resources because of the prevailing economic hardship. However, the JDB and then PTC met and submitted their budget. We have been waiting for the money to be made available, and we are very hopeful that this week or next, the concerned mechanism especially the NPTC, will provide the necessary funds that is needed for the team to go.
Gabriel says that of the 60,000 trainees expected to be screened and unified, some have deserted the training camps when their graduation didn't take place as scheduled. Lack of food, health care, and shelter in the camps are forcing many of the trainees to desert. According to the peace deal, the parties by this time should have completed training and redeployment of the unified forces 8 months from the date of signing the peace deal. For VOA News, I'm Waki Simon Wudu in Juba.
Officials with the Sudanese Relief and Rehabilitation Commission say they are appealing against a decision by a court in Elobeit that sentenced 60 South Sudanese to 6 months in prison and slapped a fine of 50,000 Sudanese pounds for illegally entering the country. Achol Malong, a South Sudanese activist in Khartoum, says children, women and men are among the South Sudanese sentenced in Elobeit. For VOA News, Viola Elias reports from Juba.
Achol Malong, a South Sudanese activist in Khartoum, says the 60 people who were sentenced to 6 months imprisoned in Elobeit did not possess any document when they entered Sudan. Malong says those detained for illegally entering Sudan were mainly from northern Bahr al-Ghazal and Warab state as well as Abyei administrative area. She says in addition to the prison sentence, the court also fined each of individuals 50,000 Sudanese pounds. The detainees were arrested in Elobeit, the capital of Sudan's North Darfur state, last week. Malong says officials from the Relief and Rehabilitation Commission in Khartoum are in touch with authorities in Elobeit regarding the matter. She says the commission will appeal the sentence and ask for the release of those detained last week. She says the sentence in Elobeit last week was not fair because South Sudanese are considered refugees in Sudan.
Now the Relief and Rehabilitation Commission is working on it, and they say that those people detained are refugees. Anyone who flees his country without any document is considered a refugee. In the past, we agree and say that South Sudanese are refugees in this country. They were convicted without the knowledge of the commission. The commission did not get any copy of the ruling.
Malong says children and women are among those jailed.
There are women, children, and 10 men. Others came from Awil. They are traveling with the buses that travel from Khartoum to Al-Miram, from Al-Miram to Awil, and Wajok. From Miram, they take bus to Al-Obeid. Another route is from Warab to Abyei, and from there to Al-Obeid, and also from Awil direct to Al-Obeid, and then to Khartoum.
William Manyond, the information minister in South Sudan's northern Bahr al-Ghazal state, says he had not received official information about the jailing of the 60 South Sudanese nationals, but read about it on social media. Manyond says in 2012, the two countries signed a cooperation agreement that allows free movement between their citizens.
We have been working together with the government of Sudan and we have bilateral relations whereby our citizens are just moving freely. We don't charge them when they come to South Sudan, especially we, and they don't charge our people when they go there. Actually, we have some refugee camps in South Darfur and also South Kordofan where our people are staying. And some of our people also moved to Khartoum and we thought maybe that bilateral relation is still active, but in case something that happens, maybe we will contact the government of Kordofan state and the government of South Darfur so that they tell us exactly what is happening there.
In March, Sudanese Judiciary Authority sentenced 600 South Sudanese refugees in Khartoum to 6 months in prison after they were found guilty of engaging in intercommunal fighting that led to the deaths of 7 people during Eid al-Fitr holidays. South Sudan in Focus reached out to the United Nations Refugees Agency, UNHCR in Khartoum, for a comment, but the UNHCR senior spokesperson in Sudan says she could contact colleagues in Elobeit to confirm the incident because mobile phone service has been cut off in Sudan. For VOA News, I am Viola Elias in Juba.
Police in Uganda suspected that a rebel group called the Allied Democratic Forces, the ADF, carried out a series of suicide bombing in the capital, Kampala, recently. The ADF is affiliated to the Islamic State, an international terror network. The latest attack killed 3 people and injured 36 in Kampala on Tuesday. Martin Ewi is a terrorism expert with the Institute of Security Studies and former head of African Union's Commission on Counterterrorism Program. He told Darren Taylor that ADF has deep roots in Uganda.
They were set up in Uganda in the early 1990s by disgruntled Muslim people who thought that Museveni had sidelined them or was not listening to them, was not taking care of them, was not involving them in governance of Uganda. So it is a group that operates now largely in the DRC, the eastern part of the DRC, where they have been carrying out numerous attacks. Especially last year, it was estimated that they carried out over 500 attacks in which more than 1,000 people were killed. So it is a group that is now well known within the region. It is no longer just a threat to Uganda.
Judging from what you said, Martin, they have quite a big capacity. Where are they getting this capacity from to carry out all these attacks?
They have been in the Democratic Republic of the Congo for some years now, where they have been involved in various illicit activities. They have been involved in illicit mining. They have been involved in illicit timber logging. They have been involved in other organized crime activities. So that has really permitted them to mobilize a lot of resources, financial resources for that matter. And also their recent contact, their recent alliance with the Islamic State will have also brought them a lot of resources. With these factors, they have been able to acquire not just capacity in terms of resources, but technical capacity. If you look at the kind of attacks that they have carried out recently, demonstrate a group that has been training, demonstrate a group that has certainly been perfecting the art of terrorism.
Why is Islamic State and the ADF targeting Uganda?
For them, attacks is a form of communication. They want to hit where they believe that the news can spread very quickly, people can be terrified, people can be intimidated, and you can see that after the attacks in Kampala, people vacated downtown Kampala, people ran away. This is exactly what the terrorists want. As I said, that they originated from Uganda, they will always want to come back to Uganda, and these attacks certainly show that they are making a solid return to Uganda.
Now, President Yoweri Museveni moved fast to announce that scores of suspects have been arrested following the latest bombings. He also said that apart from hunting the terrorists, Uganda's strategy of vigilance was minimizing damage. What do you think of the Ugandan government's efforts so far to curb terrorism, Martin?
They have better capacity now. They've gone through various trainings. We at the Institute for Security Studies, we've also provided training to Ugandan law enforcement agencies. They do have the basic capacity to be able to combat terrorism. Our trainings emphasize the need to respect human rights. Our trainings emphasize the need for precision so that there is collateral damage is minimized.
That's Martin Ewi, terrorism expert with the Institute of Security Studies and former head of the African Union Commission's counterterrorism program. He was speaking with my colleague Darren Taylor in Johannesburg. That's all we prepared for you this Thursday. We now leave you with Emmanuel Kembe and the song Kifaya. I'm John Tanza. Thanks for joining us this evening. Remember to always wash your hands with soap, practice social distancing, and wear a mask when you're in public places to protect you and others from getting COVID-19. Do not escape from COVID-19 quarantine centers because there's no cure for coronavirus. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. River Kiri.
will be free. Thanks to the God, thanks to Machakos, thanks to Nakuru, thanks to Nyanyuki. Shukran jazila leni basha, lakin nyaka ma bizip mashakil. Mashakil bijip mutu katir, umutu katir kusara kusara lena.
Kifaya, 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 kifaya ya Bwana, kifaya ala nina shukur.
Kamsinin,
kifaya.